Hi everybody, and welcome to the 45th episode of the Great Song of Ice and Fire linear reread by Vassals of Kingsgrove. My name's Bina 007, and I'll be your host today. I'm also joined by Matt.
Hey, what's up, Varley on the forums?
By Brett.
White Raven on the forums.
By Adam.
Hey, Drown Snow on the forums.
And by Nadia.
Hi everyone, it's Nadia.
So in this episode, we are still firmly in A Storm of Swords, but we get our first ever Feast for Crows chapter, which is like seriously exciting. Feels we're all grown up. And we are going to cover the events of the days 18th to the 24th of November 299. And we are going to spoil all the events, and well, not all the events, maybe some of the events in A Song of Ice and Fire, but we're not going to talk about Game of Thrones in case any of you aren't watching it. So, in the last episode, we left the Hound fighting to the death against Beric, the Don of Dondarrion, whoever changed my show notes, in Arya 6. In this week's episode, we begin with Tyrion 4. This play takes place the next day on the 18th of November 299, but we skip back two chapters. And I believe it is Varley with the mother of all notes on this chapter.
Yeah, so this has a little bit of everything, so I'm just going to go like action item style. So it starts off with Bronn and Tyrion surveying the damage from the battle, and everything's pretty fucked up. And then they go to see a bard who kind of threatens Tyrion, and Tyrion wants kind of to bribe him and realizes he can't, so he asks Bronn to take care of it, which means kill him. He gets a summons from his father. His father is getting two new cool Valyrian swords, and we get a little background on that. And then we find out that the Wall is asking for men because they believe that Jorah Mormont has been killed with all of his ranging crew. So those are like very quick recap.
Wait, they don't know that they were all killed, right? They just know that the birds came back without any notes.
Right, but Bowen Marsh in the note says they suspect that they're all been killed. So this chapter has like so many like little nuggets in it that are just great. And so like we get like the backstory of like the Lannister Valyrian steel sword. So I don't know how you guys want to do this, but I would like to put it in the way of like characters that maintain to be dicks and Tyrion.
Okay, you do however you want to do.
Okay, so first of all, Bronn's like, when Tyrion's like, they all came back to start building up their houses again. Of course they fucking did. But a great instance of foreshadowing is Bronn saying, once they're dead, they don't come back. Uh-huh. And then Tyrion fails with Silvertongue, Bronn says, oh, I know a pot shop that sells a bowl of brown with all sorts of meat. Like, what the fuck?
I just want to go back to where you were. You just said, like, once they're dead, they don't come back. And in both chapters we're about to read, they have people who kind of die. Well, the second one doesn't, but they both talk about people who die and come back.
Right, right.
The glories of the linear reread order.
Sorry about that.
So,
hey, the drum men die. Come on.
We'll see.
Tyrion's just in this really shitty mood, and you see it going from like his father wanting the impossible from him, but without like showing any like support, to like him being like, oh man, these kids are gonna hurt themselves, and then they throw shit at him, and he's like, well, fuck them, kill them all, like what the. He finds out that everyone knows what's going on in his bedroom with Sansa. Sansa's fucking miserable. And that's only because she's married to the Lannisters and held captive, right? So he like breaks the news to Shay. He like reminds himself that he broke the news to Shay, and she's like, "Yeah, whatever. Like, I'm cool." And he's like, "I don't know what I was expecting, but a little more indifference, like, or a little less indifference, would be nice."
It is amazing, isn't it, that despite all his experience with whores, all the times he's been let down, he still has the capacity to be crestfallen. For such a smart, cynical man.
Yeah.
Do you think he loves Shay?
He's not a Tyrion, but I think he does. I think he's confused and does.
So let's say Sansa accepted him for whatever reason. Do you think he would have willingly left Shay? Or do you think that would have been more of a like hard thing for him to do?
Eventually? I don't know. Because it's like she's too young to really... Like, she's not equipped for that. And, like, he doesn't really talk to her that much either.
He definitely lusts after Sansa, doesn't he? But... whether he would have had the capacity to love her, I don't know. And maybe he was just a nobleman and thought that it was okay to have... Like, maybe for him it's not inconsistent to love your aristo wife, but also love your sort of whore on the side.
That's what his dad taught him.
Well, his dad's a fucking monster.
But it is, you know, it's very common practice in this world for aristocratic men to have bastards, and maybe he just thinks that's okay. That's a man's prerogative.
So let's say Tyrion and Sansa's first night had gone like Dany and Drogo's. Like, she didn't want to do it at first, but he, like, I don't know, convinced her it was okay or whatever. And then, like, from there, it kind of would have gone better had... I don't think that would have happened, but had that been the case, it would have gone a little better. Would you think less of Tyrion for betting her?
I think we have to, because...
No!
His internal monologue just keeps on saying, like, she's young, like, I shouldn't be doing this. So, like, within the realm
but he's also like, I really want her, so... I mean, it's a little... But it's not... It's also not uncommon for them. I mean, it's creepy, but...
Yeah. Nadia, what was that?
Yeah, his internal monologue might be saying that she's too young, but that's kind of out of place for their world, because it's very, like, commonplace for them for a 13-year-old to be getting married. So it's not, like, unheard of.
I feel like if Shay had showed up and she had been 14, he would have been fine with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
How old is Shay? Do we know?
I don't think so. I don't know if Shay knows.
I never even thought about that.
Because, I mean, by all accounts, she could be, like, 14.
Well, she does give the impression that she's younger, right? Like, she comes off like a very immature gold digger.
I think she sounds like an experienced whore, though. Like, she definitely does her job well.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't think she's, like, 35, you know?
Well, she could have started at 12, for all we know.
You know.
I think she says she starts at 12. Or, like, at 12, her father started doing stuff to her, so she left.
Oh, I don't remember that.
We tend to block those things out when we read.
yeah, right.
I mean, it seems like it's in keeping with Tyrion's character not to bed Sansa, but I wonder if that's George, like, trying to keep us respecting Tyrion.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that in the way Tyrion thinks. I think we're meant to like him.
But then in Dance with Dragons, he's just a monster.
Well, yeah, but that's kind of similar to Jaime, right? In the beginning, we were supposed to, like, hate him. But then when you start...
It's an inverse relationship.
So bad. And exactly. And Tyrion goes kind of the other way.
Tyrion's been through a lot, emotionally, and physically.
So, speaking of people who have been through a lot, we get an update on Kevin Lannister that I think we all forgot. Like, what the fuck happened to him? Like, maybe we remember, like, Lancel. I think we got an insight in this chapter on why he's, like, just so against Cersei doing anything, like, in A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons. One of his children, he just learned, was murdered. The other one is held captive by his enemies. And the other one has an ulcerating wound that he took in defense of the city that I think Cersei punches or hit, like in her, like, craziness, like, during the...
trying to get Joffrey.
Yeah.
And you kind of forget, like, oh, wait, those were Kevin's kids. Like, you know, oh, he just had a kid murdered. He just, like, oh, right.
And then later on, his brother dies.
I just didn't realize that, like, they were all his kids. Like, I knew Lancel was, I think, just because of the show has Lancel and doesn't have any of the other kids. But what do you guys think? Like, he was supposed to do the job that Tyrion's doing. And that's another theme of this chapter, is that Tywin has a tool for every job, and every job, and he actually says every job for a tool. So, like, you know, who's the tool? Literally and figuratively.
I mean, Tywin's the tool, but come on.
Do you think
he is a tool? Meant for my son. What a goddamn dick.
Yeah.
He couldn't have said Jaime. No, he says, it's meant for my son. You fucker.
Yeah.
I see why Tyrion hates him so much.
You really get shit on. Like, he's given an impossible task to, like, rebuild part of the city. With what money? I don't know. Find some. Well, you know, you can forgive some of the debts. And he's like, don't be fucking absurd. Keep on paying.
Don't be ridiculous.
Yeah.
Speaking of the city, like, you know how they always talk about how it stinks all the time? Is that because people are just throwing shit out their windows onto the street and it just stays there because nobody cleans it up?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just basic. Maybe they do have rudimentary sort of sanitation and plumbing, but the city has grown in size so rapidly, it's overwhelmed it. It's like reading about Rome at its height, or London in the sort of 18th century. Or the 19th century, even before they started doing the major Victorian embankment sewage works, when these towns have these major growth spurts, people can't keep up. And then, as Tyrion rightly points out, you're in a situation where basically, I mean, law has definitely not broken down, but with the war, everything needs rebuilding. There's no money. They've got to dredge the bay. So even the bay, which might have had, you know, nice clean wind blowing across it, is going to be foul smelling because of all the dead bodies and remains of the wildfire and wrecked boats, I think.
So speaking of which, this chapter we learn that King's Landing is the principal harbor of the realm. Besides,
that surprised me. That really surprised me.
That surprised me too. I thought like
Lannisport like, or
Lannisport. Exactly.
Well, no, or, but that's on the other side of Westeros, though. Like proximity to the shipping lanes probably helps.
I mean, Old Town's been established forever. Like a lot of these places were established forever. Like King's Landing was only established when Aegon the Conqueror arrived, right? Like it wasn't a port before that. It was
only like 300 years ago.
Well, yeah, I think
like compared to like 8,000 years ago, like the Hightower in Old Town, you know, like.
Yeah, I think I remember reading somewhere that Duskendale used to be like the main port on that side of the continent, but after King's Landing was established because it was like the capital city.
I mean, it definitely makes sense, doesn't it? Because it's like London in the British Empire. What you need to have a major point is a domestic population centre to sell shit to, a navigable entrance, estuary or river, and proximity to your nearest trade routes. And that's, you know, that's what King's Landing has. But I just thought maybe like something up north or maybe, I don't know.
White Harbour?
Yeah, exactly. Because that would also have navigable routes to Essex as well.
Like White Harbour is a fairly big port like for the north and everything, but it doesn't have the easy access to like, you can bring everything into King's Landing and then you have a giant city. Plus you can get to, you know, the Reach and you know, you can go to
King's Road
get to everything
right
pretty quickly. Yeah. So it makes sense for the merchants.
Wouldn't you figure the north would be an import needed like economy more than like the southern?
Yeah, I feel like they're bringing over luxuries and not necessities though.
Yeah.
At this point. Because like it's been summer for so long.
And in the north they don't have singers and shit as much. Like they don't have all that kind of extra stuff as much. They don't have the money for it either.
300 years is a long time. I mean, I know technology is kind of stunted in Westeros, but you think that's like, for us, that's like from having horses carry messages to the internet.
Well, dude, that's like 120 years for us.
I know, but what's before horses? I mean, before people can read, I guess.
Oh, okay, Tina, I have a question for you.
Go then.
Riddle me this.
Oh, shit.
If 6 coppers can buy a melon, and a silver stag can buy a bushel of corn, and a dragon can buy a side of beef or 6 skinny piglets, how? So 30 dragons is what he offers Simon Silvertongue. That has, it, like, and this is under the sense that, like, these prices are inflated as fuck.
That's a lot of skinny piglets.
Yeah. Like,
yeah, we're going to get into this in the last chapter, too.
Like, that is a shit ton of money. Why doesn't this guy just shut the fuck up? All he's asking for is, like, the chance to play. I would have taken that money and been like, peace, I'm in Essos.
Well, I think he's kind of crazy anyway. I mean, what makes him think he can blackmail a noble? Does he realize he's just a fly to Tyrion and he'll swat him without even thinking twice about it? And there'll be nobody to defend him?
I notice a lot of undertones in their conversation where, like, Tyrion thinks he's confident because he's kind of drunk. But it seems like there's a lot of information that he has that someone's feeding him about Tyrion. And I feel like that's what's giving him more confidence than, you know, the flagon of wine.
Maybe this whole time he's been talking about Tywin.
He knows exactly what's going to happen at the wedding. Who is playing at it?
Could it be Peter Baelish? Because he's the one who sort of like...
But Peter Baelish
all this information
landing a fortnight ago, which we find out in this chapter, which is like, he really does like, I don't know, like if he's just like sailing in a circle out like by Dragonstone or something. Like,
but he has minions in King's Landing, right? And he's the one who organizes who gets those two dwarves from Essos to come to the wedding, to drop his wedding.
If he had known about Shay, he would have given her up way before that to Cersei.
He knows about her, and it was just Cersei that fucked up because, like, when they grab Aelia, like, she knows he has a whore, she just picked the wrong one.
But what I'm saying is, if Littlefinger had known about it, I feel like he would have sold that information to Cersei long ago.
Yeah, totally.
Especially since he doesn't really like Tyrion that much.
Unless he was sort of keeping it in his back pocket for like a more powerful moment, which to sort of buy some kind of information.
Though.
Yeah, but
to use leverage against Tyrion.
Yeah, or indeed to get something he needed from Cersei. Like I have this.
I think more to get it from Tyrion because I feel like Tyrion would protect that asset, whereas Cersei would just go, "Okay, I'll kill her, but I don't really care."
Yeah, probably.
Well,
you're gonna get more from Tyrion to protect the secret than you are to give it up to Cersei until after Joffrey dies.
Just the economics of it, it just seems silly. Through CSA, I had an option to buy a side of beef, and it was $500. But that's like, you know, the ribs, like it's a half a cow. So this
what's your point, Matt?
I mean, it's a shitload of money, right?
But Matt, are you seriously trying to say that your contemporary North American cost of a side of beef is in some way giving us a hint about Westerosi pricing in a fantasy world in medieval...
At Westerosi Costco's?
Yeah.
But I think we all realize that of George's many strong points, economics is not one of them, right? So we can move swiftly on.
I think it was funny at the end when Tywin's like, who's likely to bid higher than us for Jaina Slint's loyalty? And didn't Tyrion just get done saying we're broke? We don't have any fucking money.
Yeah.
No. He was saying the realm was broke. He was like, you, Dad, you the realm owes King's you Landing. A bunch of money. You can write that off. So Lannisters ain't broke.
It's like a Lannister pays his debt and a Lannister always collects his debt too.
Yeah, so. It's the realm that doesn't pay its debts.
Simon Silvertongue says, each man has his song. So I thought that was like a little, you know, nod to Song of Ice and Fire. Like, who's that about?
So Matt, do you have a song for us?
Do I? I don't know. Brett already heard it.
So what you're saying is you want to sing Sweet Nothings to Brett, but you don't want to the rest of us?
Well, he's the one that called me to hear the song. It was very nice of him.
Are you seriously not going to sing us a song?
All right.
But he's like protesting, but the guitar is right there.
It's just right
there. Oh, yeah, because it's in my back room. Like, this is my podcast room. There's my guitar in there.
Sure. No, do it. Okay.
Okay. So can you hear the guitar?
Yep.
I kind of made it like a little westerny. Rode through the streets of the city, down from the hill on high. O'er the winds and the steps and the cobbles, he rode to a woman's side. For she was a secret treasure, she was his shame and his bliss. And a chain and a keep are nothing compared to a woman's kiss. Hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm. For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm.
Brett's getting hard again.
Hard. I said wet, okay.
Moist.
Oh.
That was excellent. Cool.
Good. Matt, I think that was better than the time you sang to me.
Yeah, well,
you really stepped up your game for Bina. What the fuck?
Well, I've had a beer and, you know. So anyway, to get the chords, I found a tablature by Ethan is a Nerd 23. So thank you, Ethan is a Nerd, for figuring that out.
Yeah, props.
Okay, anyway. So we get a list of the singers for the wedding. Where's Coy and where's Aeson? Do we know that?
No,
Seven
we don't care either.
Alien of Coy, Bethany Fairfingers, Aemon Costain, Alaric of Aeson, Hamish the Harper, Coleo of Quietness, and Orland of Old Town. I've never heard of Coy.
What? They got Orland of Old Town? Oh, I can't believe I missed it.
He's so hot right now. So do we know where those are?
No.
That took out to me.
But, you know, if you had Kay Centurion's character tracker, you could probably find that shit out.
Not unless it puts him on a map.
Well, no, doesn't he have, like, literally the last time we saw every single character in A Song of Ice and Fire and where they are?
Well, we know where they're from, but we just don't know where that from is.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Tubal Mutt makes an offhanded comment, like, while they're talking about the swords, and says, these old swords remember. Is that like the North remembers? And that's why I wouldn't take the Lannister Crimson?
Yep.
Ooh.
I think
how
so.
How about like everybody who holds him eventually dies? How about that? Ooh.
And where
I don't know if that's
John
true or not. I have to think about it. What?
So Tyrion makes a big thing about like how rare these swords are and how the Lannisters have always wanted one. Do we really think Widow's Wail is still with Joffrey? Like in the grave?
No.
No, I assume Tommen had
no,
it.
No.
I don't know if Tommen actually had it, but I think it was like held for Tommen probably.
There's no way Tywin buried that with him.
Right.
Not after all he went through, and Jaime already gave away half of it.
I wonder if he told him. I want that scene.
I also like that at the end, Pycelle comes in, and Tyrion's just like, someone shaved his beard, and now it's growing back all funky.
I bet they do have that conversation like off screen, and Jamie's just like, oh yeah, I'm holding onto that sword until I can use my left hand better. I don't want it to get lost. It's in the armory.
Yep.
Oh, another thing that Tyrion thinks is when he's thinking about the crown's debt is like, if you do shit gold, father, find a privy and get to it. We get the information that if a marriage is not consummated, it can be set aside, which I think is important.
Is that the first time we hear that? Do we not know that already?
I don't think so, because we have that one guy that's married to a baby, and like everyone's like, yeah.
Oh, right, God. But I guess that could be changed, like, you know, because it's a baby, they could change that when they need to later. But I mean, like, normally, I guess that's why they have the bedding partially. But normally, you would just assume that it's been consummated. But it seems that not only are the rumors pretty vocal, but maybe Sansa's been talking. Unfortunately, like, there's no one being like, oh yeah, they've totally done it.
Why would she talk, though? Like, who is she telling? Like, the handmaids? Like, they're her friends?
My guess would be, like, Cersei's got her spies, and they're like, ooh, how is it being with the imp? I bet he's nasty or something, you know? And she's like, yeah, he hasn't touched
me. But Sansa doesn't even need to say anything, does she? I mean, Cersei and, you know, everyone's got so many spies, they'll just know the bedsheets haven't been covered in blood.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't need Sansa to be indiscreet. Because it's as much Sansa's.
Well, then couldn't Tyrion? He's a smart guy. Couldn't he just go get some like chicken blood or something and smear it on the sheets and not say anything?
Oh dear, yeah.
I will just wait for your blood, moon blood, and just smear it all over the mattress.
Okay. Well, on that note, so they make a marriage proposal for Willis Tyrell and Cersei. And Tywin says that Varys claims she told him that your sister is too old and too used. So why is Varys speaking with them? And why would Olenna stupid enough to confide anything in Varys?
Also, assuming that Tywin takes that at face value, and you know, and he therefore knows that Olenna is interfering and is very picky, and that she's rejected Cersei on very rational grounds that he knows to be true, then why would he not be suspicious in some way at the alacrity at which the Tyrells are willing to take Joff for Margaery? Does he not even in some basic level think, or maybe Elena's going to object to that too?
Well,
or
I think...
Am I being too harsh on him?
I think to some extent, he needs their army, so he kind of needs to do the Margaery and Joffrey thing. Plus, that makes them, you know, part of the royal family. Whereas
the actual heirs.
Cersei to Willis, it kind of makes the Lannisters and Tyrell, like, it takes away their home front, kind of. You know, Cersei starts having kids by him. They're the heirs, and...
The Highgarden.
Clearly, she's a little crazy.
Well, I think also that, like, Tywin knows what Joffrey is. Like you said, they need the army. But, like, Margaery, by all accounts, is, like, beloved. Like, whereas, like, Cersei is, like, a world-known, like, ambitious...
Yeah. And I think it's maybe for someone like Tywin, it's unconscionable to think like, oh, well, these people are getting an upgrade. They couldn't possibly want to kill off, you know, Joffrey. Like, I don't think that like really crosses their head.
Do you think Tywin knows the extent to which Joff is a little proto psychopath?
I think he has to.
Probably.
Well, I don't think he thinks it's as big of a deal as everyone else does.
I wouldn't put it past him to have been involved in the offing of Joffrey.
Really?
Oh, I remember that theory. Yeah, that he was Tommen's easier to control.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Joffrey obviously was going a little batshit.
And Joffrey's aging up pretty soon. He could, you know, be looking to old grandpa and saying, yeah, no thanks.
Right after he had that meeting where he was like, everybody said, you know, you just hid under the rock while my father did all the work. We act bold. He's like, thank you for that information.
Yeah.
I think Joffrey's tired. Why don't you take him to bed?
Yeah.
Joffrey needs some of his special medicine.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was the chapter. I thought it had a lot of good stuff, like foreboding stuff, like some backstory, and just like really showed how much of a prick Tywin was.
Also how clever, right? But I mean, we're now in the build up to the Red Wedding. And the fact that he's, like, given this information about the wall, he doesn't really care about the wall, but he thinks, those guys could be useful. Let me somehow, like, heavily hint that they need to sort of maneuver my guy into position. I mean, it's all done with letters and with words, which is exactly what we're going to get in the Red Wedding to achieve his
end. But just shows how he uses people. Like, he just uses people to get his own ends. And it ends
That's
up...
That's what nobles do, Barley.
Well, yeah, I know, but, yeah. I mean, he fucks over his son so bad that his son's like, you know what? I have no qualms killing you anymore. Like,
what son? Perfect. What son do you speak of?
Oh, Tyrion.
He did Tyrion me pretty well.
Yeah.
He's
do we
son.
Think? I guess on that point, do we think that had things gone differently and Jaime not joined the Kingsguard and been, you know, part of the House and the heir, like, would Tyrion have gotten a bit more of a break going forward or no?
No, I would have been shit, but just not like.
I think he would have treated him exactly the same way. Yeah, he already treats him like he's not his son.
He maybe would have had less contact with him even, because he wouldn't have needed him as much, right?
Exactly.
He doesn't need him now. I mean, he did send him to be hand
and everything. You know what I mean? Like, things like that.
I feel like that was double fold, though. Like, they can blame any problems on Tyrion, but if he does a good job, then great.
Yeah, there's no lost position. You're absolutely right. It's so clever. If he fucks up, it's not on him. If he does well, it reflects well on House Lannister.
And then blaming him for everything anyway.
Yeah, I know he is using people, but I just find it really admirable in a way. Or, you know, I don't admire the ends and I don't admire the methods, but I just think you've got to admire the intellect. Of all the players of the Game of Thrones, he's one at this point, I think, because we don't really know yet the full machinations of Littlefinger and Varys. I think he's the standout master. No,
I think so. I think even the way he dies, it's like, okay, so Varys let him out of a dungeon cell, which he crawled up inside the walls of Maegor's keep and shot him in the bathroom with a crossbow.
Yeah, but isn't that?
I can't believe you didn't see that coming, right?
Isn't that like a managerial style where it's just like, this is what happens when you treat an employee like shit for like ever? Like,
you get Michael Douglas and falling down.
I guess what I'm getting at, though, is I don't feel like that would have happened under any normal circumstance. That was a very unusual circumstance.
I agree.
Like, Tyrion be able to crawl right up into his room and, like, go by the guards without even talking to them.
And
you
indeed,
don't think he happened to be having a terrible bout with IBS?
And indeed, when we get to that chapter...
Arya wouldn't have done that?
There happened to be a chest right there that Tyrion could pull over so he could reach the crossbow.
It's all rather
but
incredible,
isn't
it?
But you don't think Arya would have done that?
Yeah, but Arya's like a trained assassin. Slightly different. I mean, I don't know. I find that
due to his actions, right?
The way in which Tywin is killed is... We can get into it when we get to that chapter, but it's like George visualized this kind of cool image of, you know, Lannister's shit girl, well, let's kill him while he's shitting. And then he's created this chapter that's incredibly hard to believe. It's just like every little thing has to fall into place to make it happen. And I know we're in a world with dragons, so it's all about suspending disbelief. But I actually find that quite poor in terms of writing. I just don't buy it.
Well, when we finally get the book from Varys' perspective, you're going to see that earlier in the day, he was in the Hand's chambers and he's like, this chest should go right here under the crossbow.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I got on his knees to see if he could reach it. Nope, I'm going to need a chest here.
Has anyone got anything else on this chapter?
What do you guys think would be scarier? The birds returning with tidings of what really happened at the Fist, or the birds showing up with no messages?
No messages. Not
knowing. You think that's scarier than what actually happened?
No messages are always worse than actually knowing, because when you actually know, you can deal with the consequences no matter how bad. That's me personally. I hate not knowing.
So why do you think Bowen Marsh mentioned the other kings? It's not a good PR move. You got to know that they're not going to take it well. Why wouldn't he write separate notes to each one?
That's
asking
a good
them
question.
For help?
That is a very good question.
Because, yeah, he should have written, you know, an individual king saying, dear king, you know.
Yes, right?
Well, I think it's political. The idea is trying to be like, look, we're the watch and we're not taking sides. But yeah, it's just going
to
piss him off.
Yeah, because what happens if you write a note to say this particular king? And then by the time it gets there, they've lost a battle. And now, say you're writing it, I don't know, hypothetically, to the Greyjoys. And then Rob defeats him and he gets it. And he's like, so you're trying to play us off against each other. It's probably more safe to just write to all kings in exactly the same letter. Because things are shifting so fast.
But like, how would they... Couldn't the Lannisters then, like, bring the army up through the north? Because they're like, oh, no, we're going... Don't worry about it. And, like, capture Winterfell just because under their, like, auspices that these are all men for the wall. Like, you have to go through an entire kingdom now to get to the wall.
Yes, true.
So maybe...
No, they could take a boat.
Yeah, and come under piracy and other people's navies.
Worked out for Alar Dean. Yeah.
So, let's say Janus Slynt was already in charge and he sent a raven telling him of the wights and the others that are attacking. Do you think they would take him seriously? Because I don't think they would.
Well, I think it's just Tywin, because Tyrion's already like been up there. He's like, there's something weird going on. He knows the watch. Like, they wouldn't request this if it wasn't.
And why doesn't Tyrion step up? He knows about the hand that Alistair brought and that the tale that Alistair told, but he doesn't say a word to Tywin. Is that because he's afraid of being mocked?
But also just bigger shit to deal with. I mean, the survival of his family at King's Landing. You've got this potential rando superstitious thing that happened. Maybe it was a one-off. Maybe it was you were drunk. Maybe you can just write it off in retrospect. putting off the unpleasant. We all do that in day-to-day life, tackling the crisis in front of you. And also, he knows that he has such little credibility with his dad, that does he really want to bring up this ghost story and just lose that 10% of, like, minor respect Tywin has for him?
Right. Kind of like he had to laugh when Alistair brought it up, because the court wouldn't respect him if he took it seriously.
Exactly. You know, and as much as we all love Tyrion, certainly at this stage of the books, you know, he can't achieve the impossible. Like, you've got to know which battles to win. He's probably not going to persuade his dad that evil Snarks and Grumpkins are coming.
Yeah, because he has to... Go ahead.
I was going to say, I guess that's a kind of point of this whole book, is like they keep on going off for like these small political gains. Like, he wants his dad to think like he's competent, so he kind of writes this off in front of him, when really, like, not only does he end up killing his dad so it doesn't matter anyway, but like the real threat comes from the north.
Yep.
In the
well, I guess when only 1% of the population is under siege, as it were, you don't really care, or they're like bitching about something, you're like, that's just that those few people, don't worry about it.
Yeah, unlike America, where the 99% are. Sorry. Bernie Sanders just hopped on the call, sorry. Kick
him off. Yeah. Okay, well, that's a pretty full discussion of this chapter, but as you said, Matt, there's tons in it, so it bears a lot of investigation. So after Tyrion 4, we jump forward to the first ever Feast for Crows chapter, and this is also the second in the published order in A Feast for Crows, so it is near the beginning. And it's Aeron I, aka the Prophet. So the jump in chapter terms is 52 chapters, but it's only one day to the 19th of November, wow. 299. So this is the biggest linear jump we've done in the reread so far. It's pretty crazy from the middle of Storm of Swords into Feast for Crows. So I think with the chapter summary, it is Nadia.
So Aeron Dampier is drowning men on Great Wick and CPRing them back to life when three noblemen come to see him and tell him that they've received news that Velon is dead, and that Aeron asks how he died, and they tell him that he was crossing a bridge during a storm when he fell and died on the rocks below, and Aeron declares that it was the storm god who killed him. One of the noblemen, who's Gorold, good brother's son, asks him to go back to see his father, and Aeron takes his horse, basically forces him to give him his horse, and he rides back. While he's going there, we get a summary of all of Velen Greyjoy's sons, most of whom died in Inti, except four who lived to adulthood, which were Balon, Euron, Victarion, and Aeron. We also hear about how another of their brothers, Oregon, died after he had been doing the finger dance with Aeron, and Aeron's axe took off a couple of his fingers, and Quellen Greyjoy's third wife got her maester to treat him, but it all went wrong. He got infected and died, and Aeron has been hating maesters ever since. He's a little obsessed with his oldest brother, Balon, even though Balon used to not treat him so well when he was a child, but he was like, I deserved it because I was, you know, always drunk and didn't do anything right. We also get some reminiscing about Euron and the creaking hinges. So he reaches Gorold Goodbrother's keep, and the Lord Goodbrother is talking to his maester, and Aeron tells him to dismiss him because he refuses to talk in front of the maester. But as soon as he turns to leave, the maester says that Euron has already come back and claimed Balon's throne. This obviously makes Aeron stop because he hates Euron. He almost doesn't believe him because he says that Euron is in exile and Balon told him that he'd die if he returned. So Goodbrother tells him that he returned to Lord's the day after the king, King Balon died, and he's claimed it. And now he's sending ravens to all of the captains of the kings of the Iron Isles to come and do homage to him. But Aeron refuses to accept it. He says only a godly man may sit the sea stone chair. Good brother asks him if Balon had decided on his heir. Aeron refuses to tell him that Balon wanted Asha to be his heir because she was, of his children, Asha was the most like him. But Aeron, who is a sexist, doesn't want a woman to be Lord of Pike and King of the Iron Islands. Sorry, Queen.
No godless man may sit the sea stone chair.
Or a woman. He says that pretty clearly. No woman or godless man.
Yeah, we don't even have to say that. Obviously, a woman can't sit the chair.
Yeah, exactly. Aeron eventually leaves Goodbrother's keep and goes back to Pebbleton, where he asked his drowned men to join him. They built a shelter for him, and he tries to go to sleep, but he can't. So he wakes up and he, in the dark, he walks into the sea. He goes into the water and finds there, and he feels that the ground god is talking to him. Feels that the king must be chosen by a king's move. So he goes back and goes to sleep, and then in the morning he gathers all the drowned men and the people in the village and everyone, and he declares that to return to the old ways, basically elect a king the old way as they used to do, and ask them all to find their way to Oldwick, where they will have a king's moat after the moon drowns and returns. I'm not sure what that means, but anyway, so that's basically it. They're going to have a king's moat.
Yeah, so like basically the next day is what that means, right? Like, or...
But what do they mean by a moon coming? Do they mean like a moon done or like the next lunar month?
Well, I mean, I think like they mean the moon drowns. I'm assuming they mean like the moon goes over the horizon, like into the ocean, right? I mean, that's what I would think.
Well, no, because that's like way too short, right? That's one day. I think
I know.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what else that would mean. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Fucking get there, guys. Jesus.
I mean, unless they consider like the moon drowning, like, yeah, the cycle of the moon, but that would be kind of a weird
maybe their analogy. Moon is like their, it's vertical for their moon or something.
They don't realize that dragons came from it.
Yeah, it's full of dragons.
Not from that moon. They came from the other moon.
No, that's like, the Kraken moon. Yeah.
It was like maybe there's this horizontal instead of vertical.
I do love how, like, he gets this news, his brother's dead, and clearly, like, Euron shows up the next day, you're like, okay, well, clearly he did it. And, like, yeah, well, Asha's not worthy. He's like, I don't like any of the options here, so fuck it. We're going to the old way, and, like, I'm in charge of our religion, kind of. I'm one of, like, the forefront members of the religion, so I get to say we're having a king's moot.
The drowned men actually want him to be, and he announces that we're going to have, you know, we need a godly man to sit the sea stone chair, and they're immediately like, oh, we want Aeron to be king, which would be such a bad idea.
I don't think any of them are a good idea.
So,
well, yeah,
maybe the reader? I don't
know.
Yeah,
honestly, Asha is the only good option here, as far as I can see, but, you know, there's no way they're going to let her be.
Well, I feel like we have a different version of what is good than they would.
Even Balon Greyjoy seemed to think that she was the right heir. Like, she would be the one to do what he wanted to do.
Well, he kind of wants his child to do it, and that makes sense. He's been grooming her for it since she was little.
Well, yeah, exactly. He's been grooming her for that.
And she's kind of like reverse Cersei almost. You know, if she'd been born a man, things would be different, but she's not like this, you know, terrible, horrible person who's going to grab power for herself.
She's also never been forced to marry someone she didn't want to.
Not yet.
Well, she has, actually. She was married to that old...
She didn't have to be there. Some seals.
Yeah,
they had seals. They had the seals.
Yeah, she wasn't there, but Euron has married her off, right?
Yeah, it was probably consummated in everything.
I love how I think, like, in the Seven Kingdoms, you have to, like, say the words, you know, before accepting or whatever. And in the Isle Islands, they're like, we'll just get some sort of sea animal to take your place if you're not here.
Do you guys think there's some magic in the fact that he resuscitates these people, or is he just kick-ass at CPR? Because he never loses
just
a man.
CPR. The description is so clear. Like, one man is pushing on his chest, and he gives them the kiss of life, which can only be...
You're so cynical, Nadia. Clearly, the drowned god flows through him.
No, he hasn't.
He can't piss farther and stronger than anyone else.
Yeah, the dude pissed out. He pissed out a Hearthfire and won a longship. I mean, there's got to be some kind of magic.
Sorry, coming back to the point about Balon preparing Asha, isn't the more important question whether he's prepared his kingdom to accept a female leader? So it's already very well grooming your daughter to be a fearsome warrior, but as we're later going to find out in the moot, that doesn't seem to go down particularly well. So in that sense, is Balon basically blinded by his, you know, nepotism and love of her to the reality of this is not really going to work?
I feel like he thought he had more time.
It's like Viserys II all over again. Like, he obviously chose his daughter to be heir, but no one else was.
I think they might have come around. Like, as he had gotten older, if he had let her take over the duties and everything, and everybody had accepted her rule, but that it never got to that point. So Balon always the guy.
I think he had a real big problem, and that was Theon, because not only was, you know, the fact Theon's never around, but I mean, he's, you know, he's the male. People are going to think that he's not around, so he's probably off somewhere just being awesome, and he could take over, right? Like, people don't know Theon in the Iron Islands. So he doesn't really have an example to be like, no, like, this is my daughter. And I think you're right. I think he had more time in his mind. You know, he was going to do the conquering and then he could, you know, set things however he wanted it. But he clearly, maybe he should have, prepared people a little better.
Okay, so given that he didn't have the time, is his daughter then unrealistic in continuing to put forward her claim? Or is it just worth a go? Because, I mean,
what else do you do?
Yeah, but I mean, it just strikes me that she should have allied with someone and rather than try and put it forward, because it was never going to work in this society.
Married her uncle.
But she tries to with
Victorian. Victorian. Right? Oh, she's hot. Imagine
if Victorian. Oh,
what a sleazebag.
But actually, I think, as creepy as it sounds, it might actually have worked out if Asha and Victorian had managed to form an alliance. Because Victorian does have, like, a very strong teeth, and Asha has, like, the brains for it.
But, I mean,
not necessarily marry, but just...
They would have had support, yeah.
I mean, if they had supported each
exactly.
other.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't necessarily have to marry each other. They just, you know, sort of put their power behind the other person and just, you know...
He could have found a queen, because they're both... she could have been, like, his right-hand person.
Exactly.
Yeah, although I don't think she would have accepted, like, she would have been willing to do that, but, you know, if they had...
It's because she's so like Balon that she presses it, right? I mean, that's why he wanted her in the first place. I think you're right, Bina. I don't think it was ever going to work in the current state of things, but...
I think her father kind of, not brainwashed her, but made her believe that she could be, and that might have been the worst thing for this scenario. Because if she had known that there was no chance they were going to let a woman become queen, she probably would have allied with Victorian and thrown, like, her votes in with him. But she was so sure that she could do it. I mean, she even had kind of a shitty case when she went before him.
Yeah, I think you're right. And actually, just it's all moot, isn't it? Because knowing what we know now, Euron...
King's moot.
Euron would
it's
have been...
It's all moot.
Exactly. But Euron would have been almost impossible to defeat, given what we know about him. Is this the first time we really learn about the Creaking Doors, or did that happen before?
I think this is the first time.
But the most alarming thing is in this chapter is how extreme Vampyr is in his religious views. Like, he refuses to accept anyone who has anything to do with, you know, the Green Lion.
But I feel that we're sort of environmentally prepared for this extreme religiosity, because by this point we've had Melisandre, we've had leeches, we've had, you know, this is all brilliant because it's just reflected all over the Seven Kingdoms, the rise of religious militancy. And so, yeah, I mean, he is bonkers in his own sweet,
and
small
then the
way.
Shadows.
But the good thing about him to this point is when we first meet him, he doesn't actually have political power. He just has religion. So the scope of his religious craziness is quite limited compared to, like, the Lord of Light, R'hllor, and all that kind of stuff, or the Faith Militant when we get there.
Does anybody know how long ago it was when he drowned and came back?
Oh, I wonder if it's in the linear
timeline. I think
timeline.
It was. No, it's in this chapter. He basically drowned at the Battle of Lannisford.
That wasn't the time, though. He drowned again. Like,
Did he drown again? Because he says that he went into the water, but the drowned god carried him.
There was two separate times.
Right.
The first time he got captured by the Lannisters.
It was during
the second time he washed
during the rebellion, right?
That was the Lannister one. But it happened since then, because it was since Theon left that it happened. Because Theon didn't recognize him as the way, because it's not the way he used to be.
Yeah, it says an unknown of time after the Greyjoy Rebellion, he went down in a storm.
Unknown. What? Unknown? Get out of here, George.
Unknown amount of time. Also, I do find it funny, like, if you listen to the audiobook, how Roy Dotrice pronounces, like, damp hair. He calls him, like, damn fair half the time. I'm like, dude.
I did that when I first read it. Like in my head, it was damp fair.
I did it too.
And I felt like such an idiot,
like,
when I realized.
Damp hair.
How long do you think his hair was? Because it's, like, down a little past his waist, right? So let's see.
Probably longer, because he hasn't cut it since he drowned. So are you trying to calculate?
And it's all knotted and matted as well.
According to the CDC, scalp hair grows at about 6 inches per year. So let's say he had a shaved head when he went under. I doubt he did. 4 feet, good. You know, it's, like, probably down to his knees if it was straight. So that would make it 8 years. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
no,
possibly.
This whole fucking conversation makes sense.
It's only this.
Let's cut him in half and see how many rings he has. Can we talk about how he killed his brother playing the finger dance, and how this is probably not uncommon for them considering their views on maesters?
Yeah, probably.
What do they do? Just soak it in seawater, see if it gets better.
Yeah.
What's their method?
Cut off a finger? Cool. Oh, it's infected. We lost another one. I mean,
he mentioned fire. Like, they obviously cauterized the wound somehow. And then do the sea water.
They don't really understand back wound care, right?
But I mean, it says like Balon or not Balon. Their father had nine. Quaylan had nine kids or nine sons or whatever it was, and like only four of them grew into adults. And they're just like, that's just life here on the Iron Islands.
He's like the worst seller for the Iron Islands. It's like hard and tough here. And it's like, oh my god, it's a fucking nightmare there.
You'll love it if you live a year.
He loves the Ironborn words too. What is dead would never die, right? I feel like that should probably be the other's words as well.
Yeah.
What is dead may never die just rises harder and stronger. That would be good for them.
Yeah, they like, should adopt like the that. Fake, they're like the fake others, like on the Iron Islands.
Anything else on this chapter?
How did Robb Stark find out that Balon died before Arion?
Distance. It's just like, you know, someone like sends a bird chapters. To
Arion seems to be on a pretty low-tech place. Like, they don't even like horses there, so who knows? Maybe he hates ravens. He definitely doesn't have a maester.
Yeah, a raven came to him and he's like, get the fuck, he ate it or something.
For the message. Ooh, the storm fire. God is feeding me.
Okay, so it seems like we've had a pretty good discussion on Aeron 1, so we now have to do a similarly massive jump back to Arya 7 in A Storm of Swords. So this is 42 chapters earlier in the books. The action, however, takes place 5 days later on November 24th, 299. This is also in the linear timeline the day that Bronn kills Silvertongue. So, with our Arya 7 summary, I believe it's Adam.
Let's see. Arya's traveling with the Brotherhood and they ambush a group of brave companions. We get a SEAL Team Brotherhood does their bit. It goes mostly well. We kind of get to see how, like, you know, this gives us a little showcase of the fact that these are some kind of the better fighters that Ned had sent out. At the end of it, all the companions are dead, save the prisoners, save for the two Dothraki that Beric let escape to go back to Harrenhal to send messages. Let's see. And then they come across the horrible Septon, who is just, like, a terrible, terrible person. And there's a brief trial, and they hang everyone, because that's just terrible people. Arya wishes they'd hung Sandor as well, but instead they treated his wounds, returned his sword, and let him go. Which kind of sucks, because he doesn't want to go away. Let's see. That night, they stay at a brewery, and one of the few standing buildings left is a monastery that once held 44 brothers. Lord Beric catches Arya looking at him and beckons her closer. Let's see, she tells him that she thought Sandor killed him, and Lem remarks that it was just a serious wound, but Thoros is a really boss healer. After Beric sends the idiot away, he mentions that some people are just kind of blind to hard truths, and he recounts all the times that he's died and Bran brought back to life. He also mentions how he's starting to lose things, like his memory. Like, I think he doesn't remember where his castle is located or whom he's betrothed, who knighted him, you know, little things like that, like what he likes for dinner, which is, you know, you where can see the cost. Keys. Yeah. What's my sigil again? Oh, good. It's on me. I remember that. Yeah, so he said the first time he came back to life, Thoros was just giving him last rites, as he'd done before, and he's giving him the fire kiss from the Lord of Light, and this time it just happened to bring him back, and it was all pretty shocking. We get, Arya does mention about, like, maybe you could bring back my dad, and they kind of have to dash her hopes. It's so sad. It's such a sad part of the chapter, because, like, he's quite long dead at this point, but for someone her age, it's a very natural question to be like, hey, I mean, I know he lost his head, and he's, like, super decomposed, but would it work on him? And,
we could probably bring him back as a Pez dispenser, but that's about it.
Jesus. Damn it, Brett. Later, Arya gets more bad news, and it turns out that Gendry decides he wants to join the Brotherhood as a blacksmith, and she's kind of hurt because she thought, well, don't you just want to come to Winterfell and be my blacksmith? Which, you know, she's not really thinking very clearly there. So Lord Beric's like, totally, and knights him for some reason. We don't really understand why, because he hasn't really done anything other than saying that he wants to work on their weapons. But I guess, you know, as I said before, any knight can make a knight, so that works out.
It's a bit like any vampire can make a vampire, isn't it?
It kind of is. And it's like, some vampires probably are, you know, are looking for the cream of the crop, and other vampires are like, I'm just lonely. So anyway,
it's all about numbers.
Yeah, that's right. Beric's like, well, we've got 100 knights. It's like, yeah, you made them all in a day. So, Beric asks the Hound how he found them and got past the sentries. Sandor said that there was enough smoke to track them from a long way off, and he may have killed the sentries. He's come for his gold. Beric's like, nope, I gave you that piece of paper, which is as good as the gold, and you're totally going to get your money back later. And Sandor's like, yeah, fuck you. I know I'm not. Give me my shit. He doesn't, because he's outnumbered. So he leaves. and they figure that that's the end of it. But they set some sentries, and they tell Aengai to kill his horse if they see him following. Some of the men want to go and kill him, but Beric says that he won his right by trial of combat, and the Lord of Light is not done with him. So then, yeah, they head off the next morning, and they assume Sandor is off to do good somewhere else.
Do the Brotherhood really believe that Beric isn't coming back from the dead? Like, do they really just think it was a flesh wound and he's fine now?
Hey,
like,
he only got cut mostly in half.
Some of them do.
Some of them, yeah.
I know he said that, yeah. But I was like, are they just keeping on a facade for Arya's sake? Or are they, like, really believe that? Like, does Lem Lemoncloak really believe, oh, nah, Doris is just...
Well, they can't, can they? I mean, the wounds are too serious.
But you can't, it's a difference between, like, if they were there and actually physically saw it, there's a difference between, like, in your head being like, holy shit, this guy had a spear through him, and he healed up with the fire kiss, and, like, this is crazy, and, like, saying that to other people, actually vocalizing it, like, kind of makes it real, and, like, you feel crazy for, like, the fact that you saw it, so it's easier just to tell other people, like, oh, no, he got better, you know?
Well, maybe yeah. They just think that the Kiss of Fire has, like, magical healing properties, and it's, like, you know, healing him somehow.
They think, yeah, they think he didn't go all the way
and
dead.
Just, yeah, they just, yeah, exactly. They just don't believe that he dead. Actually died.
I'm kind of curious about this magical healing thing, because I assume that all of a sudden Thoris can do this because the magic is returning? Is that, or is it, like, R'hllor's choice? Because I don't know why R'hllor would choose Beric. I don't know what his...
I like to think that it's, like, the whole dragons are back, magic is getting stronger.
Well, if that's the case, aren't there, like, R'hllor priests out there Melisandre... just, like, resurrecting tons of fucking people? Because they were saying this is like last rites
on accident.
Yeah, they have like all these fire whites just building up. They're like, I don't know, it's just working.
And maybe, but also like magic was around in the world before, and I think this is kind of a new thing too. Is the other part like when dragons were around, the red priests weren't just reviving people like this.
Well, so, wait,
I don't know what this has to do with. It has to do with, you know, the army north of the wall awakening, and like maybe there's some central magical something that maybe we'll never hear about that's kind of activating all this.
Oh, like can there only be one at a time?
We're on a timeline. I think that Beric was resurrected before the dragons hatched, right? Because he gets sent out by Ned. They get ambushed. That was the first time he was killed, and then he was resurrected.
But Dany's stuff happened pretty early on.
Yeah, and you know, the dragons are probably a symbol of magic getting stronger. Not exactly magic is back because the dragons are born. Right. You know, we've had this discussion before, I know, lots of times, but... You know, probably the magic brings dragons back.
The link to the timeline isn't working from the doc.
White Raven.
Dang it.
I did nothing.
White Raven.
Do you guys think it's significant that Beric's seventh life is the one that brings back Kat?
Probably.
Yeah.
Being that she was like one of the seven worshippers. And...
Yeah, that's the life of the stranger.
But then that's like two different religions mashing up into one.
Well, I mean, yeah, isn't that what it is? Like, everything is God's will, no matter what religion you are.
Is R'hllor like a religion explaining science, or is it a real thing? Like, is this whole fire stuff a kind of a science? Like, it's magic, but is it like a science, or is it, oh, there is a God making this happen?
Everything is until it's proven by science, right?
I mean, I think that's kind of the joy of the ambiguity of the books, isn't it? It's like with the Red Comet. Is it just a Red Comet? Is it sort of a sign from R'hllor? Is it a sign that the Lannisters are going to win? But I think that there are kind of magics in this book that you know are trickery, and magics that you kind of feel potentially work. And I sort of feel that this one kind of does in the same way that there's black magics that maesters can use to resurrect people in sort of horrible Frankensteinish ways. And so I think in the world, in this world, it's more like a maester. So like their version of a science rather than a pure magic, if that makes sense.
But him bringing... So you're saying that Qyburn knows magic and not like some weird Dr. Frankenstein...
No, but that's my point. I think it's Dr. Frankenstein science-y type stuff. I mean, it's all like... It's all non-rational, right? But I don't think it's magic in the sense of like Melisandre.
Or maybe it's both. You know, it's like what Thoros is doing definitely seems to be magic, right? Because he's not doing any actual healing. Like, he's not trying to patch up the wounds or anything. He's just...
He's just Frenching the dude until he comes back to life.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas Qyburn is actually doing like the science stuff and, you know, raising those dead bodies. So he's kind of like Dr. Frankenstein. And
I mean, he's such a good kisser. He makes Beric forget who he was.
Yeah. He doesn't even remember his wife or who he's betrothed to.
Right.
What's her name? Who cares?
Going to Arya for a second. Like she was saying, like, oh, it's like a mummer's trace. Arya has become so numb to death. It's crazy. Like the fact that she just contemplates killing people without even thinking of them as people almost.
I still think she's so young and she has been so exposed to death where it's just like, you know, like when you think you're like, you're young and like petulant and you're like, ah, I don't need this at all. Like, she's like, ah, I don't need this person at all. Like, they could be dead. Like, I could kill them.
Yeah, they're just dolls to her.
Yeah.
People are dolls. We'll make a mummer tree. It'll be fun.
Yeah, when she starts putting like her hand up people's asses, then we'll know. My theory will be
Does anybody else get so disappointed that Arya never meets Nymeria in these Riverland scenes when they start talking about wolves? My first time reading it, I was like, shit, here it is. Here it is. They're going to reunite. They're going to reunite. And then it doesn't happen. And I get so frustrated with it. Man. It's almost like George hates me and all he wants to do is crush my hopes and dreams.
I don't like anybody.
He lives on the souls of optimistic people and he just drains them. I think that's what it is.
He's like a hope vampire.
Kinda.
Yeah, a pessimistic vampire. He's just like, I'll take all optimism from the world. And every now and then I have to like refill the cup. So like
I'll throw a tweet out.
Longer and longer before he has to do that. So that Septa is really a fucking asshole, huh?
Oh my gosh.
And like how much like the bloody mummers are like, yeah dude, you're cool, you can chill with them.
Yeah, they don't care. None of them are boys. Why do they care?
I really don't like the bloody mummers. I find move on.
You can thank your friend Tywin for that.
Well, quite.
Weren't you just singing his praises earlier?
Yeah, because I think he's really clever. It doesn't mean I like what he achieves with his cleverness, but you still like objectively speaking, the guy is smart and he goes about getting his objectives accomplished.
Yeah, by using the bloody mummers.
I don't know. He dropped them like a bad habit. He no issues. He's just like, yeah, whatever. They're not with us anymore. Go ahead and kill him.
Mm. Anything else on this chapter?
I think it's weird how, you know, that the Brotherhood wants, like, they steal his gold. But what's the point? I feel like you can't buy anything with gold anymore because nobody's taking in gold in the Riverlands.
Not in the Riverlands.
Like, what are they doing with it though? Like, don't they we got all this gold
or something or? You know what it is? You know what they're fucking doing? Beric Dondarrion. Okay, hear me out here. He is sending all down to the merchants of House Dondarrion to buy shit for the Riverland.
He's just keeping all the gold.
Yeah! He's enriching his house. I mean, like, they're the only vendors to the Riverlands right now, and he just keeps on taking people's money and being like, oh, this will help out.
No way I'm doing that. I can't remember who I am.
Yeah. Like, I don't even remember what castle I was supposed to be betrothed to that I'm giving all this gold to. Like,
but
he never had any meetings with Russia.
I guess what my point is like, what good is gold and silver and currency when there's no laws or enforcement officials, so you just take what you want?
But there's nothing necessarily to take either, right? I mean, okay, paper money means nothing. They don't even have it yet. And what else do you want to do? You sort of start getting paid in barter? But the point is that like the lands have been raised, haven't they? It's not like people have a whole bunch of chickens and shit to start bartering.
Right.
This is a very resource-poor, commodity-poor area of the world. Whatever can be eaten or stolen and ridden away, it's already happened.
So you think he's using that gold to import stuff for the people?
Maybe.
I think he says that, right? Like they
He's trying to buy one of the summer islands so they can get the hell out of there.
Just him and Thoros on their own little island.
Yeah.
My ties.
But then again, as a bunch of roaming sort of bandits, it's hard to know how something as complex as sending your gold somewhere else, getting commodities from like shipped in and then distributed. I mean, it just seems like a very complex operation for people who are of no fixed abode, put it that way.
And that's why the Hound is like, bullshit.
Yeah, and they, and they seem pretty isolated from like the world, right? Just in giving out the paper money, obviously nobody can claim that after the war. And I don't think they're necessarily like bringing stuff from outside. Probably, you know, they just need the money for regular maintenance stuff, like, you know, feeding the horses, feeding people. They're probably buying stuff that's already coming in from like Gull Town and whatever.
It's a good like populist campaign, right? Like they're like, oh, we'll spend the night in your inn and eat your food and you'll feed us because we're working for you. But really, like, you know, they're not doing anything.
But they are like protecting the people, right? And the people seem to support them in doing that.
Yeah.
I guess they're the only military body in the area that does protect the small folks, so I don't see why they wouldn't support them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, when they're robbing like people, yeah, I guess it's just like people like the Hound. But they're trying to extort money from the Starks.
As far as they can see, they're not actually robbing people because that paper that they had, Vandor, they actually believe that they're, you know, like giving him a written guarantee that he'll get the money back after the war, even though that kind of, you know.
No, he's been good in forage.
Naive.
But yeah, it seems like they're just anybody going through the, like the King's Road, they seem to just be robbing him. Because look at what, like when Jaime and Brienne go through, they plan on robbing them.
Absolutely, and that shows the breakdown of Floral Order.
Hold on. You're saying that they're being robbed, but they're clearly being left with forms of repayment. Let's keep that.
Exactly. They believe that they're actually giving people a written guarantee. It's just naive to believe that anyone will ever get their money back after the war.
Yeah, showing that
he wasn't dead, he was just severely wounded. We're going to repay them. It's just, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's just that the whole system is breaking down, and there are no guarantees, right?
What name are they signing on the bottom of these scripts? Are they like,
King Robert?
King Landing is going to pay you. Like, I don't understand who would be paying it.
Yeah, I don't think Derek remembers anything else. Like, he just remembers that he was sent out in the name of King Robert, and that's, you know, that they're doing the king's justice, and by king, they're referring to Robert.
Yeah, but this is like, they're all like the Nigerian princes, like, oh yeah, you'll get all this money if you just send me, like, you know, give me all your money now and you'll get more later. And everyone's like, sure, take my cash.
Go ahead and show up at King's Landing with a writ saying that Robert is going to pay you and see what Tywin says.
Literally, the Iron Bank is doing that right now, and King's Landing is saying no.
Yeah.
Does anybody think if Arya had been returned, it would have changed anything for Rob and Kat?
No, just that Arya would have been killed.
Yeah, she would have died along with them.
What I'm saying is the whole Jon thing might not have even happened. What we assume is Jon's thing, because Kat might have been like, well, Arya's still around. You know, does Kat go with them because Arya's there?
Oh, yeah, and actually probably Arya might have been left back at River Run, maybe. You know, would they have taken her along to the wedding?
Have her protected?
Or maybe they would have married her off to a Frey as well to make peace, I guess. But she might
have survived. She's already contracted to marry a Frey.
Exactly. So maybe they would have just... So maybe then they would have had to have taken her, because it's weird if she's betrothed to a Frey not taken to take her.
Yeah.
And so she just ends up
and
dead.
And maybe she wouldn't... Yeah, she... The Freys might not have planned... If she had been there, if she had been going to marry that Frey, the Freys would probably have pushed for that wedding to happen at the same time as Edmure's wedding. And then they wouldn't have planned to kill Daria. Like, they would have planned to take her captive, just like Edmure. But then she would have fought back and she would have died anyway.
Okay.
So, yeah, Arya would be dead.
So they say the Hound wouldn't kill them in their sleep. Do you guys believe that? Like, if it meant his survival, I think he would have killed them in their sleep.
I think in extremis he would, but in general, the Hound has a lot more honor than most people who claim they have honor. So I think,
kind of like Jaime.
And I think he has more respect for them than he does for other people, too. Like,
I don't know.
Well, they did
the dude is a boozer, and they have his beer money.
But when he's at that inn with Arya, he doesn't like go straight in and try to kill them out and then, even though he obviously hates them. He waits for them to start him, and then he starts him, then he fights back, right? So I don't think he would have killed them in their sleep.
Like I said, unless it meant his survival. I think he would if it meant his survival.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's all I have.
Yeah, can we talk about Aengai blowing his prize money instead? Like, what the hell?
Okay, so he won 10,000 dragons, right? How many sides of beef and blowjobs did he get that he spent all of it?
Ala Yaya should be able to retire at this point, I would think.
Yeah, right? She bought the crown.
It is interesting that he has two different kinds of arrows, and I wonder how he has them, like, differentiated. Like, does he have two separate quivers?
Or could it just be different, like, fletching or something, maybe? I mean, I had to look it up because I was like, wait, so he has, like, the more, like, instead of normal arrowheads, he has basically, like, the spears, you know, for plate armor.
Yeah.
Or, like, so from arpons.
Does he just, like, line them up in front of him so he can quickly... Like, that's what he does with Arya, but is that what he does all the time? He just, like, lines up arrows in front of him? He's like, okay, this one, okay, this one, okay, this one. Because I feel like if it was, like, on a quiver...
That doesn't sound too practical, right? What if he has to move on another mission?
It's not militarily.
Maybe it's just the luck
sensible.
Of the draw.
Right. He's like, okay, this one's going to go through armor. I'll aim at that guy.
Yeah. Got to hit this other guy in the face because it won't punch through his breastplate. So.
I think the two quivers just make sense, right? You know, just
like one on each shoulder.
Yeah, like a gunslinger in reverse.
Yeah. Possibly.
Well, you could have one quiver that just had like a divider between it, like a small divider where you'd put like a pocket of these other arrows.
Yeah.
She's just like reaching over your shoulder. I feel like he's not gonna look at him.
No, but it would that would provide enough of a like a distinction between where the arrows laid that you would know you would reach the back for one arrow to the front for another arrow or something like that.
Maybe put something like sticky or something on them.
Oh, come on, let's keep this clean. Okay.
Do you guys?
No, because I was thinking if I was reaching behind me, like in a movie theater to steal someone's popcorn, I would definitely not want like the taffy popcorn. I'd want like the white cheddar popcorn. And the white cheddar popcorn has that little like cheddar dust that's fucking like crack. So like you'd know just by touch which popcorn I'd want to steal.
Varley, hold on a second. How many times have you stolen popcorn in the movie theater?
This isn't about me stealing popcorn at the movie theater. This is about figuring out which feather.
Peter, take us home.
Okay, well, that sounds like an end of the discussion on that chapter. With that, I want to thank everyone for participating in today's episode. I've been Bina 007, but thank you to Nadia, Matt, Adam, and Brett.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks in particular to Vardy for serenading us so beautifully.
You're welcome, my lady.
Thank you. for those of you this reading along at home, the chapters that we'll be covering in episode 46 are Arya 8, Jaime 5, and Dany 6. So those will feature the High Heart caught by Sander, the bathhouse scene with Jaime 5, quite sort of iconic.
Ooh, that's a good one.
And Dany basically stuck in Marine because, hey, that's Dany for the next, you know, two books. Ever. Or whatever. Exactly.
Forever
and ever.
Because we're not getting a new book ever.
I feel like
we discussed that news that it's not even coming out in 2018.
I feel I already did that on a reread and I did it on the 5-year gap. I'm kind of like almost bored of talking about how bored I am waiting for the books. I'm at a meta level of boredom right now.
What are you guys gonna do for 400?
Think, well, it depends, because like it's coming upon us fast, right? I mean, like
very quick. Yeah,
we've been talking about it, and then scheduling was a nightmare, and I decided that I had done the FCR script, so I wasn't gonna bother doing the scheduling. Someone else could do that. But it's basically because we're coming up to the Red Wedding in the reread, we thought we'd do the Red Wedding as an FCR. But it's just going to be a nightmare to get everyone scheduled, so I'm not sure if it'll work. But
is it because you keep on saying schedule?
Fuck you. Back to the Valkyrie, there at last. We were the Grey Sound Boys. We break, we just make dead. Under warmth of the warheads, we float away on silvery sands, perfecting my useless charms. How's everybody doing today?
Oh, fantastic now. So excited.
But you've been serenaded. You've had love poured over Skype toward you.
My nipples are so hard.
What happened?
Just stay out of this, boy.
It's a visual image that once you've seen, you can't unsee.
My hard nipples?